From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ever since Darwin published his radical theory of evolution 150 years ago, there have been skeptics and gaps in our understanding. And one aspect, even after the DNA revolution burst into the 20th century, that has never been entirely explained. It's the question of novelty in the evolutionary process. How did such gloriously novel, complex, and elegant new structures, from the wing structure of the dragonfly to the lens of the human eye, come to their design? And how could something so apparently random as mutation be the answer? Creationists and today's intelligent design advocates have taken up that question and used it as a sharp weapon in the cultural battle of ideas. Our guest today, Harvard evolutionary biologist Mark Kirschner, has a bold new answer that fills in the picture with science and new insights into the core molecular processes that have engineered from within the complexity of life as we know it. This hour on Point, producing complexity and startling new science in the debate over evolution. We begin this hour, though, in Pennsylvania, where the intelligent design debate is playing out in a Harrisburg courtroom. Eight families in the Dover Area School District have sued the Board of Education there to have references to intelligent design removed from the school curriculum. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Paul Nussbaum. He's national correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he's been following the trial. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Remind us of what's going on in the trial in Harrisburg.
Essentially, it's a lawsuit that was brought by, as you said, families of students in the Dover Area School District who complained that the requirement that students be introduced to the notion that there are gaps in Darwinian evolution and that there is an alternative called intelligent design is a violation of the separation of church and state.
What provoked the lawsuit? How did this get into the school curriculum?
The school board adopted last fall a statement that it required be read to the students in ninth grade biology class, essentially saying that there are gaps in evolutionary theory and that there is an alternative theory called intelligent design. If you'd like to learn more about intelligent design, we have books in the library called Of Pandas and People. Please refer to that book to learn more about this and on with the class.
And around that conflict or that requirement, a great national debate now swirls. Where does the trial stand and what's been heard by the judge and jury so far?
Well, there's no jury. It's just a bench trial, so
okay.
Only a judge is hearing it. It's in federal district court in Harrisburg. The plaintiffs, the parents, have put on their case, and this week the defense, the school board, has begun its case. Its only witness so far is a biologist, a molecular biologist from Lehigh University, Michael Behe, who's mm-hmm. been one of the main proponents of intelligent design. He testified yesterday and is on the witness stand again today.
So there's much more to be heard from the defense. What were the arguments made representing the parents in court?
The parents, to oversimplify vastly, essentially said that intelligent design is really creationism, that by asking our students to learn about intelligent design, they're injecting creationism in the classroom. Creationism is one particular brand of religion, and we don't want our students exposed to that because the Constitution prevents that. Like I said, that oversimplifies the case. And the ACLU, who's representing the parents, have brought in a number of eminent scientists and philosophers and theologians to make that argument.
And the counter voice that began to be heard this week saying there are gaps, intelligent design may explain them, students need to at least to be aware of that perspective.
That's right. And then it goes one step further and says not only do we want students to be aware of the gaps, but we want them to be aware of an alternative, this notion called intelligent design.
What's the scene there, Ben, Paul? A lot of comparisons made in the press to the Scopes monkey trial, famous trial of decades ago. Is there that kind of circus atmosphere in Harrisburg or not?
No, unfortunately. The people that would make that comparison, I think, would would be sad to see that it's a pretty mundane it's a mundane setting. The courtroom, it's full, but it's certainly not packed. There are not people waiting outside. The courtroom is not a circus atmosphere at all. There are very professionally behaving lawyers on both sides, and probably 15, 20, 30, depending on the day and the witness, reporters in the courtroom, and a handful of public spectators, probably never more than 30, sometimes fewer than that.
But quite high stakes. We read that the legal ramifications of this could be great for the teaching of evolution and intelligent designs mentions across the country. Is that right?
I think that's true. I think that this is going to be important for both sides in this ongoing debate, and that it's such a big part of our culture that it's a conversation that's happening at all levels and in many jurisdictions, that I think whichever side wins in this case, it will be important for them, and whichever side loses is almost certain to appeal.
And if that appeal goes on up the chain of courts, could it lead to intelligent design being barred from American classrooms?
Yes, if the courts find, as the American Civil Liberties Union is arguing, that intelligent design does represent promoting a specific religious viewpoint, then that would violate what the Supreme Court has said can be taught in public school classrooms. There would still be room to introduce the subject in non-science classrooms, in social studies classes or philosophy classes, but it could not be advocated as a scientific theory.
What's the calendar look like there, Paul? How long until this may come to a conclusion in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania?
They're predicting early November, so probably the first week of November will be the end of the case.
Coming right up, we'll be watching. Paul, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Paul Nussbaum, national correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He spoke with me from Philadelphia. We are talking this hour about a new theory that speaks to a key question in Darwin's theory of evolution, the question of novelty and how complex new features have succeeded, have joined the evolutionary parade. You can join the conversation. Are you dazzled by Darwin's theory? Have you remained, after all these years, a doubter? Are you ready for new science to fill in the gaps? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Mark Kirshner. He's professor and chair of the Department of Systems Biology at Harvard Medical School and the co-author with John Gerhardt of the new book, The Plausibility of Life, Resolving Darwin's Dilemma. Mark Kirshner, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
So, Darwin's Dilemma, what was it? What is it?
Well, I think Darwin's dilemma was understanding how variation is generated in nature. I mean, we have to go back to, I think, to understanding what evolution is. I mean, evolution is something we're all confronted with. Every culture has had a myth about the original creation of life.
Mm-hmm.
And Darwin's was really the first modern scientific theory. It was commonly called survival of the fittest, mm-hmm. and most people think of that as evolution. But in fact, survival of the fittest was only one part of Darwin's theory. It was the part he understood.
And pretty easy for all of us to understand.
And pretty easy to animal breeders, plant breeders, they understand that that the weaker organisms don't last and the stronger organisms succeed. That
mm-hmm.
was pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a wonderful job of scouring the earth and collecting data to support this theory. But he needed two other theories to support his theory of evolution. One was a theory of heredity, because he had to know in his theory how each animal would pass its characteristics down to the next generation.
And before our understanding of genetics, that wasn't so clear.
Well, in fact, he came up with his own theory of genetics, now fortunately forgotten because it was totally wrong in all aspects.
Okay.
But he knew he needed it. And now, of course, with the genetic theory so well established that we have the idea of genes, DNA, anybody who sort of watches CSI or the O.J. Simpson trial knows that this is now beyond skepticism.
Passing on traits, we understand how that works.
We understand how that works. The last part of the theory was something that no one has really understood until very recently, And that is, how do the genes generate the organism? How do they generate the animals and plants? And how do we generate variation? How do we generate new forms out of that?
Because, of course, the idea is that things started as a single cell or less.
That's right. So there were, and so there's if we look back from us to single cells, we see a tremendous amount of novelty. The first multicellular organism, the first animals with backbones, the first eyes, the first limbs, the first brains. And they seem to have been created out of nothing. So that has been the dilemma, to explain how do you generate novelty.
And that's where intelligent design continues to put its nose into the tent, because
And also because in some sense it was the most vulnerable part of the theory, since we've only known about how this works for the last 10 or 20 years. So they're right to raise the question as to, how does novelty generate it? But, of course, they're not listening to the answer.
So you are now honing in on this and bringing us a new fleshed-out explanation here. We're going to hear it after the break, but at heart, you're saying, there's a molecular structure that is itself geared toward variation.
That's right. That's right. That actually is built to vary and built to generate interesting and important and non-lethal and functional outcomes.
We are not playing God here today, but we are trying to describe, to define, to understand some of the questions that have been so persistent around Darwin's theory of evolution, questions that are surprisingly hot in our society today. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Mark Kirschner, co-author, along with John Gerhardt, of the new book, The Plausibility of Life. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are in this hour filling in the last holes in Darwin's theory of evolution, sewing up the theory as creationists and intelligent design advocates have a heyday with it, really around the country right now. My guest is Mark Kirschner. He's professor of systems biology at Harvard Medical School and co-author, along with John Gerhardt, of the new book, The Plausibility of Life, Resolving Darwin's Dilemma. You can join the conversation. Have you been awed by the astounding complexity of life on Earth? Have you searched for its explanation? Do you hear it here today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark Kirschner, we're going to get you right to work here to take us into the heart of this. You've got a major new scientific theory. You call it facilitated variation. We want to understand that. You say ignorance about novelty and how it occurs is at the heart of skepticism about evolution. There's plenty of skepticism out there today. So what's the theory? If it's not God designing these marvelous things, from the human eyeball to the bat's wing to the dragonfly's wing, how is it working? Where do these variations come from? In all their complexity, we've had people on this show, George Gilder was here a few weeks ago, he said, you can't possibly come up with that level of complexity just, without any design behind it. Richard Dawkins, the great evolutionary biologist, of course, refuting that. You're refuting it very specifically. Take us in to your theory.
Yes, I think maybe if we go back to the historical roots in a way, the 19th century was a wonderful time for looking for variation. Museums were built, the first natural history museums. People built zoos for the first time. These were not just menageries for the rich, but research centers for people to come and examine all the wonderful creatures that they were being found in the various distant lands.
And a great time because the great age of the sail was taking scientists like Darwin all over the world, to the Galapagos.
That's right. And people were marching to look at the origin of the Nile and finding islands that were never discovered before and finding creatures there that were unimaginable.
British sea captains being tasked to bring them back.
Absolutely.
To London.
And for economic reasons as well, because so many of these plants and animals were of economic value. Mm-hmm. So the impression that was going on by, the turn of the 20th century was that the variety of life was even more unimaginable than we thought at the time of before the 19th century, or certainly in biblical times.
Mm-hmm. An astounding variety.
But at the same time, there was another development going on in science, the scientists were looking internally into the organism. They were looking at the cells. They were looking at the genes. They were looking at the way it processes food and makes materials. And they were finding an awesome paradox, really, that as the variety was increasing in the nature of life, the similarity of the way the organisms were built was just hitting people right in the face.
So they may have looked incredibly diverse, from giraffes to great tortoises and all the rest, but essentially at the cellular level, lots in common.
Lots in common, and it was like they looked under the hood of this animal, and they found the same engine. And that, of course, has been really the history of the 20th century, and more it's been the same. But the question is, that actually is a paradox, if you think about it, because although it certainly supports the notion that we all arose from a common source, it doesn't explain where the variation came from.
If the guts are so similar, why are the expressions so diverse?
That's right. And that, I think, has been the contribution of the last 20 years, really of the time that we first began to understand how we develop from the egg to the adult, which is, I think, a process every bit as complex as evolution itself. And some say echoes evolution because every property of the animal that changes means the property of generating it has also changed. So that's what you have to look for, the differences, not just the differences in the bones, but the way the bones are made in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So we had this sort of paradox. On the one hand, life seemed to be all the same, which I said makes us all feel that we have come from a common origin, which was one of Darwin's great ideas. At the same time, we couldn't find the differences. Now we know that the way the animal's constructed is almost like Lego blocks. These are common, rigid, non-interconvertible pieces, but they have amazing capacity to be linked together in new forms. So you can make a soccer ball out of Lego blocks. You can make an Eiffel Tower out of Lego blocks, and the components of our cells are built in such a way that even though they're not malleable like molding clay that you can push into different shapes, they can be assembled very readily into different shapes, and that's really what this book is about.
That description, we've all seen and played with Legos. We get that. The tricky piece that I think comes into the national debate, the cultural debate, is about that complexity itself. Not just that we can make many things from the basic building blocks, that seems clear, but how do we get to that design? People taking the human eye and saying it is not possible that by what Darwin initially described as by random mutation, you could get to this complexity, the balance of elements within a human eye, which allow it to perform this function. You and John Gerhardt say that there's a deep molecular biology in the cell that actually fosters biological novelties, as you put it, when plants and animals need them most. Mm-hmm. How does that work? How is that possible?
Well, first of all, there are really two kinds of variation that we have to deal with. One is the variation in evolution, which is what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. The other kind is the variation that we have in our own bodies as a response to our physiological needs. For example, if we work out a lot in the gym, our muscles get bigger.
Okay.
Our bones can get bigger. We sweat when we're hot. We shiver when we're cold. All of these are physiological responses to try to change the animal to respond to the actual physical external conditions.
We get that as a metaphor, but yet how do you get from that to I'm bumping into walls so I develop an eyeball?
Yeah. Well, the point is that these are the responses to the external environment, but internally we also have responses that allow us to develop in the first place. And these responses are very, very adaptive. Some of the things we talk about, for example, the veins and arteries of our body don't have a plan. They just explore the body during our own development.
To look for the course that they'll ultimately take, where they're going to lie within the muscle, next to the bone.
They actually look for a place where oxygen is needed most.
And go to it.
So when you make a novel limb, let's say, you don't have to make a novel vascular system. It will search out and find the place that the blood is needed.
Now, when you say a novel limb, you mean, for example, a human arm or the wing of a swan.
That's right.
Or
That's right.
But still, something's going on.
Oh, of course, there's still mutation. There's still change, but the kinds of changes are less creative than you might think. The organism is prepared to change in certain ways. It can change the length of bones. It can change the size of bones, and so many other properties of the animal. The muscles grow out to associate with the bones wherever they are. The nerves grow out to find the muscles wherever they are. The blood vessels go out to find the nerves and the muscles and the bone wherever they are. So these things just reduce. I don't say novelty isn't required. You need new mutations. You need time to accumulate them. But it's not as much novelty as people thought.
So it still depends on mutation.
Absolutely.
Mutation as the source of the new design.
Right.
But that you're saying that the cells of life themselves are there ready to adapt and fill in and support the mutation when it's effective.
That's right. And there are also the various circuits within the body are built to be easily reconnected without much retooling. So it's there are things, the metaphor of machines is that if you break one thing, the whole machine breaks. But these are very adaptive processes that can be easily reconnected to repair themselves. And we see that in life. When somebody has a stroke, the brain can repair itself. And that's kind of a process that can be made use of in evolution as well.
So does this answer the question? You go all the way back to this wonderful story, of course, from 1802. The good Reverend William Paley describes himself wandering on the heath and stumbles across a brass watch.
Right.
And he says, look, I could stub my toe on a stone, and I understand how the stone, that's not hard to understand. But the watch, a watch could not be there without a maker. Does your theory then explain what's at the heart of so much of this debate that's out there today? Does it explain how we actually come to not just the support of the eye once it gets going, but the design of the eye, the complexity of that design?
Yes. Well, I think the complexity of design involves some new things, but not many new things. I mean, it's very interesting. The eye has been designed twice, at least, in nature. The eye of the insect and the eye of the human are completely different in their chemical organization. But the chemical structures that make up the eye of the insect and the eye of the human being are present both in the insect and the human being. They're present, really, in almost all cells. So the toolbox was already there. It just required some assembly. And that, of course, does take some random change and mutation, but you don't have to create, as you would, a brass watch. If you're going to make, if you have a brass watch and now you want to make a clock out of it, you can't just retool that brass watch to make a clock. You have to retool every component. Here we have all the components sitting in a toolbox. A few changes can put them together in functional forms. And I think that's really, doesn't mean that it doesn't take some time and some random mutation to generate things, but the whole system is built to be retooled and to generate functional outcomes.
I can hear the questions in the minds of listeners from many angles, from the skeptics, well, who built the toolkit in the first place? Mm-hmm. We'll look at that. My guest is Mark Kirschner. He's co-author with John Gerhardt of the new book, The Plausibility of Life, Resolving Darwin's Dilemma. It poses a major new scientific theory, facilitated variation, saying that the basic molecular biology of the cell, as you're hearing, is ready to run with mutations when they're working. And it comes at a time when all this is, of course, very hot. I want to turn right now to Denver, Colorado. We're joined there by Eugenie Scott. She's executive director of the National Center for Science Education, a leader in the field of public understanding of science, author of Evolution Versus Creationism. Eugenie Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
I wonder how you see this new theory playing into the national conversation that's going on, has gone on for a long time, but has gotten hot again lately about evolution and intelligent design. Do you see this intersecting with that debate in a way that will resolve it?
Oh, absolutely. The kinds of things that Mark and John have been working on are the intelligent design folks' worst nightmare, because what they've been saying all along is that it is impossible to explain. It is a categorically unexplainable problem as to how you get new body plans, things like limbs and segments and the rest. And the work that Mark and his colleagues have been doing on Evo-Devo, or evolution and development, show how you can get a perfectly reasonable natural explanation to get things like differences between mollusks and arthropods, say. And so, again, it just underscores the basic weakness of the intelligent design argument, which is they confuse unexplained with unexplainable.
You pay a lot of attention to the arguments that are being made in that camp. Of course, you're carrying the torch for science.
That's my day job, yes.
As you listen to Mark Kirshner's explanation for what they've uncovered here, what they're uncovering, how do you hear the intelligent design advocates coming back at this? Play the devil's advocate for Mark Kirshner for a moment.
Oh, well, if I'm going to put on my intelligent design hat, which doesn't fit terribly well, but I'll do my best,
okay.
They would say, yes, but. They're great at saying yes, but. Yes, but, Mark, you haven't shown us a detailed step-by-step sequence of these enzymes and structures that get you from point A to point B. And we will not be happy until you do that because there are gaps in your model.
Mark Kirshner, there's the yes, but, as voiced by Eugenie Scott. How do you respond?
Well, it's great to hear Eugenie present this argument. It's not one she usually does. I would agree with yes, but. I mean, we're fascinated by the questions of how things actually happen, the specific things of how they actually happen. We have a broad general idea how they happen throughout biology and specific ideas in a few cases. Evolution is one of the most exciting fields of biology today, and any attempt to portray it as just a stagnant dogma, it doesn't do it justice. There are lots of wonderful questions. But it's interesting, the more we examine biology in its most intimate details, the less we find reason to invoke something like intelligent design. There is no indication in any of the modern biological discoveries and investigations of any requirement for something like intelligent design. Now, if you want to say that unless we can answer every specific mechanistic question in science, then everything in science is completely wrong, and we shouldn't even bother to investigate it, then I would say we're in real trouble. I mean, you could then say, for example, we understand something about leukemia, and that's okay, but we don't understand very much about lung cancer, and therefore we shouldn't even investigate it. We should just leave it as some property of an intelligent designer.
Or if you insist upon knowing every single nuance of a scientific explanation before you accept it, don't get on elevators, because we still have plenty to learn about gravitation.
So watch out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Eugenie Scott, we've just got you for a couple of minutes more. Do you think that there is a scientific argument out there that can put this argument to bed, or is it really beyond science? Is it ultimately a question of beliefs?
You know, it is a question of belief, because what we find in the intelligent design position is really a simplification of an earlier anti-evolution movement called creation science. Intelligent design has been rhetorically very successful in presenting itself as the next new thing and a wonderful new advance in our understanding of science. But everything you see in intelligent design you saw previously in creation science, which is being brought out in the trial in Harrisburg on the Dover policy.
Right.
And so, ultimately, we are never going to solve this problem by just throwing science at it. Obviously, we need the science, and we need the kind of information that Mark and John and their other colleagues are coming up with, and it's wonderful to have this kind of ammo. But ultimately, you have to assuage people's concerns about science itself, because I think the biggest problem that we have out there is people hear conversations like we're having, we can explain X through natural cause. And many people jump to the unwarranted conclusion that means we're now saying, and God had nothing to do with it. But of course, if you're studying cell division, nobody says, here's an enzyme that causes the chromosomes to line up in the center, and God had nothing to do with it. I mean, that's not how we teach science. But when we're talking about evolution, people sort of automatically make that connection. And I think people have to understand that all we're trying to do in science is explain the natural world, and we're limiting ourselves to natural cause, not because we're all a bunch of atheists, because we aren't, but we're limiting ourselves to natural cause, like we're talking about here, because we can't test explanations based on God.
But you always run up against the language in the beginning.
In the beginning.
And off we go from there. Eugenie, I know we have to let you go. We're very grateful to you for being with us. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Mark, it's nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Eugenie.
Eugenie Scott, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. We're talking in this hour about the last holes in Darwin's theory of evolution, maybe filling them in. My guest is Mark Kirshner, co-author of The Plausibility of Life, Resolving Darwin's Dilemma. How did we get all this complexity? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're working on the last holes in Darwin's theory of evolution. This hour, my guest is Mark Kirshner, professor of systems biology at Harvard Medical School, co-author with John Gerhardt of the new book, The Plausibility of Life, Resolving Darwin's Dilemma. They pose a big new theory here, facilitated variation, it's called, that deals with the complexity of life as we see it, how life got there from the dragonfly's wing to your own eyeball. You can join the conversation. Have you been awed by the astounding complexity of life on Earth? Have you searched for an explanation for how it came to be? Do you hear it in the theory we're talking about today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Merle is calling from Gastonia, North Carolina. Hi, Merle. You're on the air.
Hello.
What do you think, my friend?
I don't understand at all. I don't understand where we all came from to start with. I mean, if one cell evolved and evolution is correct, where'd the one cell come from? And it even gets deeper, you know. I could understand a human limb evolving, even heard of some animals have one cut off and it grow back, but... Mm. You go deep into somebody's mind and their memory and dreams and things like that. I could never imagine that would come from evolution or just by chance or happenstance or accident or whatever. And even what happens to us when we do die, you know, can all this memory and feelings and emotions and understanding just cease to be, just stop? You know, that's a mind-boggling thing to me. I can't understand that. Can't fathom it.
There's no question it's mind-boggling, Merle. Let me ask you, when you see how incredibly complex and kind of splendid life is, is it possible that, and it's hard for me to understand as well, it's so complex, it's so deep, but is it possible that that's simply the fact that you and I are not molecular biologists, that we haven't spent our lifetime studying it?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, I know I don't even claim to be even a scientist. I didn't get very good grades in school, you know, but I still can't understand... where it all came from to begin with.
We've got it, Merle, and we appreciate your perspective. It's a very common one. Many people look out on the unbelievable diversity of life and share exactly the same response. Mark Kirshner, what are you saying to us in response to this kind of perspective, that when you look under the hood, it's not as complicated as it seems, or it is just that vastly complicated, but science is step by step figuring it out? Do you share at the end of your understanding Merle's, readiness to turn to the divine, it sounds to me, for that final tenth of a mile to comprehension?
Well, first of all, I think it's very good to have the questions that Merle has, and I think it's also, from my point of view, very important to limit what we can explain, what we can't explain. There is a line to be drawn between faith and science, and a lot of the questions that Merle raises I have no explanation for. For example, I think we really understand very well now how we went from a single cell to a human being and the general features of it, but we really don't understand how the first cell was made. And if I were teaching school, I would just say, you know, we don't understand that. And there are lots of possible explanations there, and leave it at that, not try to drag evolution into an area that we don't understand. He talked about death and memory and all these other things, which some of which we're trying to understand, but some of which we don't understand. And I think we do a disservice to science and a disservice to faith if we try to drag faith into areas where we have natural explanations, and we drag science into areas where we have no natural explanations.
So keep them in their own realms. But as you do that, do you do it with a confidence that ultimately science will explain it all?
You know, I don't know. For example, the origin of life is a very big question. We don't have an answer for it, and it's quite possible we never will have an answer. On the other hand, the basic process of evolution, we have better and better understandings for, and I think now becoming more and more complete, still lots of questions to be asked. So I just don't know. And I think it's important to be able to say, I don't know.
But if we deny the search that's led to that understanding of evolution by simply saying it's the hand of the divine, then your work never happens, because why bother?
That's right. I mean, I think we have to begin. We have to ask questions, and we have to seek answers, and where we can get scientific natural answers that are testable experimentally, then we need to be able to teach those as those answers.
Patrick's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I enjoy your program very much.
Thank you.
My question was, what are the intelligent design people, why are they so afraid? It seems like they're so afraid of us trying to find the answers to the beginning of life and to try to answer those very questions that you were just asking about. When there's plenty of men of science who create cures and do wonderful scientific research, who believe in God himself, and Darwin himself remained very religious until the day that he died. And what I just failed to understand is, why are they so afraid of us finding the answers? And can't they see that as a next step of our human evolution, is that we actually discovered where we come from, and now we are ready to evolve as a race or a species?
You take us almost into the realm of theology here, Patrick, and maybe out of cell biology. But Mark Kirshner, it's where you live. So how do you think about that? How do you respond?
Well, I don't know exactly what all their motivations are. I think to some extent, they think it's a cheap shot. That is, they can undermine science and maybe support their own faith. And then nobody pays much of a price. Does it really matter if we understand evolution or we don't? But they don't realize that evolution is really the basis for understanding biology. And if someone were to draw a line between understanding evolution and understanding colon cancer, they might hesitate a little more about the notion that this is something you can just debate on and on. I'm very worried about their discouraging investigations into important areas of biology, but I don't really fully understand their motivation.
We've got more callers, but I've got to come back to the core thing here. We've just got 3 minutes left, Mark Kirshner. Take us to the eyeball question. Okay, here's the great chain of evolution. There's the eyeball. How does an eyeball emerge with your theory of facilitated variation?
Well, I mean, first of all, Bea in his book discusses vision. This is the intelligent design advocate who's presently testifying in Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
in Harrisburg. And he discusses the eyeball, and he says, you know, the deeper you look, the more complex it is. Therefore, the more unlikely it is to have arisen by this kind of process. But it's not really how complex something is. It's the nature of the complexity that's important. And in the eyeball, we know, for example, that the ability to respond to light is something shared by all animals, including bacteria. And the same protein is used in terms of responding to light in that initial response. All the circuitry between the initial response and the signal to the brain is all made up of the sheer dowry of interlocking components, these Lego blocks that I talked about, that are easily assembled into circuits.
But a plant turns to light, so there's a very basic level at which we respond to light. The eye, a kind of great variation on an instinct like that?
Well, I mean, initially the responses to light are just like that, avoiding light or seeking light. But as you develop a more complex nervous system and as you make more and more of these photoreceptors, you can get different spatial differences in the eye. You can tell light coming from above and light coming from below. And eventually we know, for example, that the lens of the eye has been invented numerous times out of different materials. So easy it is to make some sort of transparent structure that that focuses light. So it seems like this has not been much of a barrier.
And, of course, the more effective an organism would be in perceiving light, in responding to light, presumably then you get back into your survival of the fittest.
Absolutely. This is the variation on which Darwin's survival of the fittest depends.
And that then that evolution, that mutation that makes a creature more adept at that survives, comes on, and we're the lucky beneficiaries all these eons later.
Right.
Is your theory disputed?
Our theory is really based on facts that have been accumulated over the last 10 or 20 years in biology, and I don't think anyone disputes the facts. So far, the response of the scientific community has been very positive. I think it's not the kind of theory that is going to be strongly disputed, but it remains to be seen. As I said, we chose to present this theory in a lay language version of a book because we thought the ideas are ones that could be understood by the general public. We'll have to see how the scientific community responds.
Lift the hood with a good guide, a good mechanic. When we've got one today, and things become a lot more comprehensible, even if mysteries remain. Mark Kirshner, we're very grateful to you for your research, for the book, and for being with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Harvard's Mark Kirshner, along with John Gerhardt, co-author of The Plausibility of Life, Resolving Darwin's Dilemma. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a jungle trek into Madagascar's biological wonderland. This is On Point. Like Darwin's Galapagos Islands, the island of Madagascar, off Africa's east coast, is one of the most dynamic ecological habitats in the world. Madagascar is widely recognized as one of the world's top biodiversity hotspots, home to more than 200,000 plants and animals, and many found nowhere else on Earth. Stephen Goodman is one of the world's leading Madagascar wildlife researchers. The conservation biologist is also one of this year's MacArthur Fellows, a so-called Genius Grant recipient. In this radio diary, Stephen Goodman takes us deep into Madagascar for a look at life in a vibrant but imperiled ecosystem.
Many of the places that we go into haven't been really visited by outsiders. And thus one of the critical aspects from a social perspective is to go in and have a reconnaissance mission. And you ask for a meeting of the village elders. Porters come and meet us, and boom, off we go. We finally arrive at the campsite, and if it's possible that same day, we will start installing a whole assortment of different traps and nets and things that we can capture animals. In 1993, we were up at the summit of a mountain in northern Madagascar, a mountain called Anjanahara Bay. And the summit is kind of this mystical place. Everything is covered with dripping moss. And it was on the second or third morning after I had put out my traps. I remember the trap was on a branch that was covered with very, very thick moss. And, you know, it sounds a bit silly, but I know the smell of these animals. And I smelled the trap, because these are metal boxes and you can actually see the animal in this inside. And it had a very strange smell. And I knew that it was something that I hadn't encountered before. Kind of opened the trap a little bit to see what was inside, but I didn't want the thing to jump out, so I kind of put the clothes trap in my trap bag, and with incredible anticipation, went back to the camp and pulled it out of the trap, and I had no idea what it was. Absolutely no idea. In fact, it turned out to be not only a new species to science, but a new genus to science. There are now estimates of a minimum of 12,000 species of plants on Madagascar, and that could go easily to 13,500 or 15,000 species. Somewhere between 80 and 85% occur nowhere else in the world. Basically, the common theme to all of this is Madagascar is extremely unique. In 1988 or 89, I was with a group of biologists in southeastern Madagascar, and we surveyed a very interesting forest that I don't think anyone had ever been to before us. And the herpetologists on that trip captured at least two animals that were new to science. Those descriptions were written up and were accepted to scientific journals. One of the editors of one of the journals actually asked for some habitat photos. By coincidence, I was going down in that area for Christmas holidays, and the fellow asked me to try to get images of the forest. We went back to the place, and the forest had disappeared. And these papers were associated with the description of species new to science, but probably it was a description of extinct organisms. In the course of 3 years, an important block of forest that had unique organisms disappeared. Cut for slash and burn agriculture. It's difficult to protect what you don't know. So with a vision of conservation, until you really understand what occurs in these different forest blocks, both within and outside of protected areas, it's very, very difficult to come up with a coherent program for protection. And that's one of the important things that's come out of all this work is the ability to say, yes, this zone that is unprotected should be given the highest priority because it encompasses a whole series of unique organisms that occur nowhere else in any protected area in Madagascar.
Stephen Goodman is one of the world's leading authorities on wildlife in Madagascar and a biologist at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History. His book, The Natural History of Madagascar, is the definitive guide to the island's ecology. For more information on Madagascar, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Special thanks to independent producer Daniel Grossman for venturing into the Madagascar jungle for today's sound. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.